Good morning and welcome to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. It's a weekly program about health, nutrition, fitness, and all things lifestyle.
And I am Dave Cushing. It's book day. We have a really big show for you with three guests, starting with the writer Doug Abrams, who will tell us about the Book of Joy Journal. It's a follow-on to last year's The Book of Joy, in which the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu delve deeply into the pathway to joyful living.
Yes, and in almost the same vein, next up will be Albert Flynn DeSilver. He's an American poet, a memoirist, novelist, speaker, and workshop leader who will join us to talk about his new book on how the seemingly opposed processes of meditation and writing can lead to spiritual awakening.
And finally, Dr. Victoria Sweet shares with us her approach to patient care, which she and others are calling slow medicine. Hey, this should be a fascinating hour.
Yes, it should. This is The Mountain Life. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words from our underwriters.
Matt here from San Francisco Design, supporting our local radio station, KPCW. Since 1990, San Francisco Design offers interior design and a mix of European and mountain contemporary home furnishings with store locations in Salt Lake City and Park City on Bonanza Drive. On the web at sanfrandesign.com, San Francisco Design, love your home.
Josh here, owner of Este Pizza and delighted to support KPCW. Located at 1781 Sidewinder Drive in Prospector, Este Pizzeria offers New York-style pizza with hand-tossed dough, homemade sauces, as well as vegan and gluten-free items. Open daily for lunch and dinner, 435-731-8970 or estepizzaco.com.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Dave Cushing.
Hello, Lynn.
Hi, Dave. Well, a while back, Doug Abrams spent a week, how about this, with the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu in Dharamsala, India, as the two spiritual leaders discussed their lives, their philosophies, the state of the world, and the inherently human trait that we call joy, all of which led to Abrams' 2016 work called The Book of Joy. This year, he has published the Book of Joy Journal, which supplements the first book. Doug Abrams, we're glad you could join us. Welcome to The Mountain Life.
It's great to be with you.
Doug, first of all, you just have to tell us, take us through this week that you spent with the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. That must have been the pinnacle of your life's experience.
It was pretty great. It was almost as awesome as marrying my wife and having my babies, but it truly was one of the most extraordinary experiences and certainly the peak experience of my professional life. And we went to Dharamsala, India, which is in the foothills of the Himalayas, where the Dalai Lama lives in exile from Tibet. And we went for a week of deep dialogues on the nature of human happiness and how we can have more joy in our lives. It was the Dalai Lama's 80th birthday, so while we were there, we actually got to celebrate his birthday and watch him dance for the first time in his life. He taught us to meditate. It was incredible.
And obviously,
yeah, it was an amazing experience.
Obviously, you're a wonderful, talented person, but really, how was it you that was chosen?
Great question. I have been lucky enough to work with Archbishop Desmond Tutu for the last decade on all of his book projects, and we were actually down in South Africa at his wife's birthday party when a friend of mine, who was the chairman of the Dalai Lama Foundation, asked about the idea of the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu writing a book together. And I said, wow, that sounds like a fantastic idea. What would it be about? We both paused for a moment and then just looked at each other and said, joy, because these are two of the most joyful people on the planet. And so we were having sandwiches at Archbishop Tutu's office at that moment, and I turned to Archbishop Tutu, or Arch as he's known to his friends, and I said, hey, Arch, you want to do a book with the Dalai Lama? And he said, I'd do anything with that man. And so we were off to the races. And I will say that, I was called upon to serve as the narrator for the Book of Joy and to facilitate the interviews. And I definitely, leading up to those interviews, and especially the night before when I was awoken at kind of 3 in the morning with a lot of self-doubt, wondered when Oprah Winfrey or Anderson Cooper was going to come in and do the interviews.
Super interesting. Well, maybe you can start by helping our audience understand why joy is a state of being, as you say in the book, rather than a simple emotion that someone feels.
That is a great question. I think the fundamental goal of the book was to try to help people understand that joy is not just a fleeting emotion that comes when we're listening to good music or having a good meal, but that joy is something that we can turn from a fleeting state to an enduring character trait. And I think that's what you see with these two men, is that their sense of joy and well-being is not something that's dependent on external circumstance. It's from within them. And that's what we wanted to try to bottle up for the world and understand, how do they do that? And how can we experience joy in the face and of real adversity and the real suffering that exists in our world?
Well, can you boil that down to...
Sure.
Yeah, how do you achieve this state?
Sure.
What are some
of the five key steps?
There
are a couple of things that they talked about that were fascinating. So the discussion explored the nature of true joy, and then we went into the obstacles to joy. So the kind of everything from fear and frustration all the way up to illness and death. And then talked about what they called the 8 pillars of joy. And so what they said was understanding that it's not about getting rid of fear, anger, and sadness. These are, they're basically 4 fundamental human emotions. There's fear, anger, sadness, and joy. And 3 of those you can see are often called negative emotions, fear, anger, and sadness, but they're fundamentally human emotions that evolve to help us. So it's not about denigrating those emotions. It's about recognizing that we don't have to live in those emotions, that we can learn to traverse those emotions more quickly and recover more quickly to our kind of natural birthright, which is joy. And one of the things they explained was that it's not about searching after and rushing after joy and happiness. As Archbishop Tutu said, that's the quickest way to missing the bus. What you actually need to do is cultivate these 8 pillars of joy, that when you cultivate those in your life, you naturally have more joy. And I can go into those 8 pillars if you would like.
Well, if you could go just quickly into them, but before you do, let me ask you this. Is there a way to parlay happiness into joy? Because I think we can all say that we experience happiness, but probably all of our listeners are right now going, well, I don't know. Do I have joy? I'm not sure. I have a lot of happiness. Do I have joy?
Well, so that's a great question, which is, what's the difference between happiness and joy? And happiness, frankly, the big distinction that they made between joy and happiness is that happiness is often dependent on external circumstances. It's like, well, I'm really happy because I had a great day at the office, or I'm really happy because I got the promotion, or I got the car, or I'm listening to great music. Whereas joy is this kind of internal state of well-being and joyfulness that we've all experienced, but it's not dependent on anything outside of us. It's not dependent on anything happening in the outside world. And that's what these men are so capable of experiencing in their life. And I think all of our listeners probably know that experience of joyfulness, whether it's, in an extreme version is the birth of a child, to even just the joyfulness of a deep relationship and a connection, being with loved ones or friends. That's the very human state of joy.
So the eight pillars.
And when we're talking about happiness, we're often talking about joy, really.
Right, right. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Doug Abrams. He's joining us to talk about the Book of Joy and now the new Book of Joy Journal. Doug spent a week with the Dalai Lama and Archbishop Desmond Tutu in Dharamsala, where the Dalai Lama has been in exile. He spent a week moderating and now narrating the Book of Joy. The Book of Joy came out last year, the Book of Joy Journal just recently. So those eight pillars of joy, I mean, they start with something that you would maybe not suspect, like humility or acceptance.
Right, right. So there were four pillars of the mind and four pillars of the heart. And the first pillar of the mind is perspective. And that was really interesting to hear them talk about how so much of our well-being and our experience of life is based on our perspective. And when we are able to step back and get a wider perspective on our life or on the events of our world, then we actually don't get pulled into our problems in the way that they can be if we're only focusing on them and that's filling all of our reality. Then we see all the heartbreak and heartache, and that becomes everything. But if we can step back and have that wider perspective, we can see that those challenges that we face in our life, or even the challenges we face as a country or in our world, are only part of the picture. And that perspective, as you point out, actually leads us to a natural state of humility as well, which is a recognition that we are one of the 7 billion people on the planet, no better or no worse than anyone else. And that humility, they said, leads to a sense of humor, this natural kind of sense of humor where we're able to laugh at ourselves and at our problems. And that was so amazing the entire week. They were laughing the entire time. These guys were as much a comedy duo as two revered holy men. They call each other their mischievous spiritual brother. And they were just, and it's been wonderful to hear people talk about how not only inspiring is the Book of Joy, but how entertaining it is just hearing them laugh and joke with each other. And it was really amazing. But just to finish up the fourth of the pillars of the mind and the pillars of joy, that sense of humor and that ability to laugh at ourselves and laugh at our life allows us to have a sense of acceptance of the reality that we're facing, which doesn't mean that we acquiesce to it or we accept it in the sense that we're not planning to change it, but we just have to accept that it exists. So the Archbishop Tutu, who was one of the people most responsible for the transformation of his nation from a racist apartheid state into a free democratic country, did not accept the inevitability of his country's problems, but he did accept the reality of what he was facing.
Right. So that's an introduction to the four pillars of joy in the mind. Makes sense to ask you, well, what are the four of the heart?
Well, those four follow from the four of the mind. So once you're able to accept the reality of what is, you actually are also able to step more easily into forgiveness, which is the first pillar of the heart and the first pillar of joy, or what they call the four pillars of the heart. And that ability to accept our current reality also allows us to accept what was and to give up the hope of a different past, which is the nature of forgiveness, which doesn't mean we forget. It doesn't mean we don't seek justice. It just means that we're able to forgive and move on and disentangle ourselves from the ones that we have not forgiven. And then that forgiveness leads us to a state of gratitude, which is a recognition of everything that we have in our life and the abundance that we have, and a recognition of all that we are fortunate or blessed to have. And then from that sense of gratitude, we naturally move into a state of compassion and a desire for others to have as much as we have, and ultimately to generosity, which is really compassion in action and the desire to share what we have, whether that's our material well-being or our time or generosity of the spirit with others.
Hmm. Such great stuff. Doug Abrams with The Book of Joy, which came out last year, and now he's back along with the Dalai Lama and Archbishop, or Arch, I like that, Desmond Tutu, with the Book of Joy Journal. Thank you so much for joining us today, Doug.
Oh, it's been a pleasure being with you. Thank you for your wonderful show. Take care.
The Book of Joy Journal is interesting because it contains a number of nuggets of wisdom about the practice of joy. And also, it contains many, many, many blank spaces with lines that are numbered where you can record your own journey towards joyful practice. And they point out that you don't have to tie it to any day. It's just, let's go to number 60 and see what I wrote on that particular episode.
Yeah, I want Doug Abrams' job. Don't you, Dave? I mean,
yes,
hanging out with the Dalai Lama.
Absolutely. And watching a person dance for the first time ever at age 80.
So wonderful.
That's amazing.
Well, stay with us. We're launching into another conversation after we hear from our underwriters. This one is about, oh, how you can write your own book of joy when we return. It's The Mountain Life.
This is Nanette Bush with Fairway Independent Mortgage, supporter and longtime listener of KPCW. Fairway Independent Mortgage offers personal home, vacation home, and investment property lending. Our mortgage team partners with local realtors to provide our clients with resources to understand the home finance process. Located at 1700 Park Avenue or at nanettebush.com.
Da, 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 da. Can four notes change the world? Beethoven's Symphony No. 5 is one of the most recognizable pieces of music, and it still has the power to surprise. Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, October 20th and 21st at 7:30 p.m. in Abravanel Hall. For tickets starting at $21, visit utahsymphony.org. Utah Symphony Utah Opera is a nonprofit organization and a supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life here at KPCW in Park City. I'm Dave Cushing with Lynn Ware Peak. Our next guest has a broad and varied background, including a stint as the Poet Laureate of Marin County, California. Starting with a BFA in photography, DeSilva veered toward the various avenues of writing, including not only poetry, but also fiction and memoirs. His 2012 book, Beamish Boy, chronicles his own harrowing and inspirational journey from suicidal alcoholic to literary success and beyond. It's a redemptive story of survival and letting go as we follow Albert from one zany adventure and near-death experience to the next. Well, today he joins us to discuss his new book, Writing as a Path to Awakening, A Year to Becoming an Excellent Writer and Living an Awakened Life. Well then, Albert, hello.
Hello, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet, and let me start by asking you to talk about the final element of your path, awakening. Can you describe for our audience what you mean by awakening?
Oh, geez. Yeah, language. It's so easy to get caught up in these various terms. And, you know, ultimately, how do we define that which can't be talked about or even spoken about. But by awakening, I think what I really mean is waking up to a sense of presence and a sense of love and a sense of heart and connection to the world, a sense of one's own creative genius, one's own creative possibility for the world. You know, for much of my life, I was asleep. Like, not literally sleepwalking, but metaphorically sleepwalking through the world, really bound by my own conditioning, my own story. And it wasn't until I started writing into that story that I began to free up and reconnect with a greater sense of who I was and what my potential was in this lifetime.
Right, and your book is based on learnings that you've been developing or insights that you've had while doing a series of writing workshops. Can you describe these workshops and some of the outcomes?
So that's actually really where the book came from. I've been teaching these workshops with adults for, I want to say about 7 or 8 years at, in various locations throughout the country and a little bit in Canada up at Hollyhock and places like Omega Institute and Esalen Institute and Spirit Rock Meditation Center and Shambhala Mountain Center, which is not too far from you guys. And the intentionality around that is really creating space, creating stillness, allowing silence to inform and help us reconnect to our creativity, and also providing a kind of a safe space for people to explore their own stories without judgment, without self-recrimination, without a hovering, critiquing, judgmental kind of atmosphere. It's a very generative kind of engagement with language and with writing. And the idea is really to kind of reconnect with who am I? What is my story? What is my creative potential? And so the workshops really alternate back and forth between stillness and silence, meditation time, and writing. Some are guided exercises. Some is just open writing time.
Mm. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Albert DeSilver. He has come out with a new book called Writing as a Path to Awakening, A Year to Becoming an Excellent Writer and Living an Awakened Life. And, so many questions are sort of popping into my head right now, because what you say, Albert, about, I've been to day-long writing workshops, and mm-hmm. there are these prompts to get you to access your creativity. But it seems really ineffective once I hear you talking about sort of this meditative process to unlock your creativity and explore your own story. That seems like so much more of an effective way to do it. And it just leads me back to your book, Beamish Boy, which is such an amazing book about your story. Can you talk about, you went from being asleep, as you say, or sleepwalking or whatever it was, to being able to write this expose of a crazy life?
Yeah. Well, I sort of figured, I had two very deep and dark strikes against me, and I woke up that second time still actually alive. I sort of realized that I'm alive. I need to pull myself together here and make a stand for not only for myself but for the world. Like, what am I gonna give back? How am I gonna serve in this way? I mean, I've been really so lucky, and I think that the intention became, first of all, to sort of dust myself off and figure out, who am I really? Am I this lost creature who's sort of at the whim of his emotional past, or, is there some space behind that? Is there some realm of possibility behind that? And it was really through the practice of meditation, a good therapist, of course, and reconnecting to family and friends and taking care of myself in a really basic way that helped me get back on track and find my creativity and be able to write my story in order to let go of my story.
Right. So do you think that the process of writing also helps unlock people's stories? I mean, I think we go through life and we don't think about we lock away entire portions of our lives, and, like you say, with some good therapy, maybe we can bring it out. But writing seems like such a great path to do that.
It is. I mean, in my own experience, it's been so healing, and I think it's a real gateway to, how do we know what we think or know what we feel until we write it down? And I like to say that writing is is one of the most powerful points of focus we have as human beings. And because we're so familiar with it, we don't really think about that so much, and we're always jotting down notes and so forth. But when we bring a sense of presence, a sense of intentionality to it, whether that's creatively to write a novel or a memoir or poems or whatever, or whether that's to be focused about what we want in our lives in terms of relationship, in terms of money, in terms of health and wellness, in terms of spirituality, it can really bring a concentrated point of focus and attention that helps to shift things emotionally. It helps to shift things psychologically, and can really have a dramatic, in my experience, have a very dramatic effect on creating what we want in our experience.
Well, your subhead to the book talks about a year to becoming an excellent writer. So
Right. Tell
me about some of the stages that someone who embarks on this pathway might go through in this year.
Yeah, so I mean, of course, I'm sure, you know, it's interesting. I've been doing so many interviews around this book, and nobody's really called me out on that year thing. Like, can somebody really become an excellent writer in a single year? And in my experience, you can. You can become an excellent writer in an instant when there is the right context and the right support and the courage. You know, I think writing ultimately is a very courageous act. Yeah. Particularly when you take that next step and open up to the world. So the book is set up in these 12 chapters that are themed, that are meant to guide people through a kind of an evolutionary process of, first of all, setting the groundwork, you know, setting kind of premise, a different premise, and there's even little precepts in there. And then it goes through January, February, March, and they're themed. So we begin in January with rebirth, and then we come into February, which is what is February? I'm totally drawing a blank on my own book. February is becoming, and March is emergence, and April is blossoming. And so they're meant to kind of build and expand on each other and interweave through these very basic support elements and ideas around different aspects of writing.
Super interesting. Now, can you also talk just for a minute or two about this seemingly contradictory business of meditation, which is all about letting go and abandoning narrative, and the writing process, which is about getting things and focusing down on a point? That's an interesting contradiction.
Yeah, sure. And it is, because when we do write and when we do read, we're using our cognitive faculties very intensely. And yet in meditation, we're letting that go. And we're trying to enter into that space of silence, that space of emptiness, that space of nothingness. And I think why it's so powerful to alternate between the two is because the spaciousness nourishes the sense of possibility and the sense of knowledge. Like, I never really thought of myself as a particularly smart or intellectually, rigorous kind of person. But it wasn't until I started really meditating and sitting that I realized at a certain level that all knowledge is available to me. You know, I just have to create the space for that in my heart, in my mind, and sort of reconnect with the energies of knowledge to access that and to be willing to engage in that. And then that knowledge sort of becomes available. And so when you enter into a deep kind of meditation, you realize that is the stream of creativity. It's always there. It's always acting in the world, right? I mean, think about all the spontaneous miracles of life that are happening around us all the time that oftentimes we just don't notice because we're so busy in our little human minds. But when you get quiet, you can join into that stream, and that nourishes the future or the momentary creativity and the momentary knowledge.
Oh, this is great stuff. Yeah. Well, the book is Writing is a Path to Awakening, A Year to Becoming an Excellent Writer and Living an Awakened Life. Our guest is Albert DeSilver. And you were through Park City, maybe a month or so ago. And I assume you were going between the Bay Area and the Shambhala Mountain Center in Colorado. Is that right?
I was, yeah. And I've been on book tour and was, you know, in Denver and all that. But, God, I got to say, I really, really love Park City. The last couple of years, I've spent more and more time there and spending a little bit of time in Salt Lake on this tour, just visiting people and the bookstores and really, really enjoying the community. You're so lucky there.
Oh, and, yeah, thank you. Well, maybe we can get you here for a workshop. That would be fun.
Oh, that would be delightful.
We have to create our own little mountain meditation center. I think we've got a few of those around. Before I let you go, real quickly, we've got about 30 seconds, but I just have to ask you about The Beamish Boy, because I'm really enjoying that book. I've gotten a little sidetracked while I've been reading it, but The Beamish Boy, it comes from the poem Jabberwocky, Lewis Carroll's, and why that? Why The Beamish Boy?
My father used to call me his Beamish Boy, and this is kind of an archaic term of endearment or affection. He didn't call me that nearly enough, but he did call me that. And it became this whole sort of interesting theme, you know, because of the poetry, because of the transformational experience of going from darkness into light.
Yeah.
And I kind of couldn't resist it.
Oh, I love it.
Had these multiple layers.
Yeah, it's a great book. All right, Albert, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life. We'll look forward to seeing you here in Park City.
Yeah, what an honor and delight. Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. Bye for now.
And we'll be back after these words with our third interview with Dr. Victoria Sweet. This is about slow medicine. You'll want to hear this. Really interesting.
This is Matt Kelly of ParkCityHomeTeam.com, proud sponsor of The Local View with Randy Barton. Our Keller Williams team brings attention to detail to every step of your real estate transaction, from our first meeting to negotiating and all the many steps leading to a smooth and successful closing. Our mission is all about you. ParkCityHomeTeam.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics and KPCW supporter, providing knee and shoulder care focused on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing. We are now incorporating stem cell therapy and regenerative orthopedics. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with my co-host Dave Cushing. Our final guest is Dr. Victoria Sweet, who was an internist at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital for more than 20 years, an experience that she chronicled in a book we interviewed her about 5 years ago, The God's Hotel, a doctor, a hospital, and a pilgrimage to the heart of medicine. As Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine at the University of California, San Francisco, she's also a prize-winning historian with a PhD in history and social medicine. Her current book, Slow Medicine, is about the trend to push back against today's computer screen-oriented model of healthcare. It argues that everyone deserves to be seen and treated with true caring. Dave and I spoke to Victoria by phone yesterday. Victoria Sweet, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Oh, thanks for having me, Lynn.
So, Victoria, we talked to you when you came out with God's Hotel, and we loved that. I think that was, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, or I lose track of time.
It was 5 years ago.
Oh,
whoa.
Wow.
Wow.
Well, that's how I feel. I feel like, what kind of year is that? It feels like about, you know,
last
it does. It feels like a year or two. It's amazing.
Yeah. Well, I remember that being so heartful and full of soul, and I just really loved that story. And we remain in the Bay Area in Berkeley, where this slow medicine movement is taking shape. And you were sort of, I mean, from what I can tell by reading online, you were the founder of this. And you know, you sort of make this correlation between the slow food movement and the slow medicine movement. So maybe you could start with explaining, you know, just how that came to be.
So first of all, let me say that I'm one of a number of doctors who came up with this idea of slow medicine almost within about 6 months of each other, but unbeknownst to each other. So it's one of those movements that just pops up, has been popping up all over the world, really, but in very isolated cases, but independently, and which always tells me that it means it's something whose time has come.
Yes.
So the connection was kind of obvious in a way to make, I think you could say, between slow medicine and slow food, if you're in a place. So because if we hadn't had slow food, nobody ever would have thought of it. But for me, what happened was, especially being in the Bay Area, where, you know, slow food actually was begun by an Italian who spent a lot of time in Berkeley, Carlo Petrini. And when he went back to Italy, he was shocked to see that fast food was taking over his beautiful country's food. And he was so shocked. He's the one who went, wait, if there's fast food, we've got to have slow food. So it was, he came up with it as opposed to fast food. Yeah. So its intrinsic meaning of the slow, I think, is not so much the time as in opposition to fast food. And with slow medicine, for me anyway, it's not so much about time per se, but in opposition to fast medicine, which is what we've all been having to suddenly deal with, this sort of analogous industrial idea of healthcare, you know, healthcare providers on a production line producing healthcare for you, the consumer. So the slow medicine movement in the States has popped up in a number of places, and the docs who've come up with it have a little bit different ideas about it. So I'm going to talk about mine. So for me, the slow part is to do not so much with the amount of time, but the kind of time we have with our patients. So I've practiced medicine for years and years and years, and one of the things I was struck by, and what I talk about in this book especially, and try and communicate in my new book, Slow Medicine, is that it's the kind of time that the doctor and patient have together. It's a kind of time analogous to the slow food. It's a time that's face-to-face, that's personal, that has to do with process. And what makes it fascinating as a doc and important is that when I have that kind of time with the patient and I have the time face-to-face to listen to what the patient says and doesn't say, I have the time to thoroughly examine the patient and collect all the clues about what's really going on, that's when I'm most likely to get the right diagnosis and the right treatment and, ironically, for the least amount of money. So it's actually, slow medicine is actually more efficient than its opposite of the factory model of fast medicine.
Right.
That gives you some flavor.
Right, which is so interesting because the reason that fast medicine is perpetrated upon us, or whatever you want to say, is because it's supposed to be efficient and doctors have a caseload that needs to be, you know, they need to see so many patients in a day, and that's why it has to be fast and that's supposedly efficient. And when, as you're talking, I just think about the visits that I've had to my naturopathic physician who looks at my tongue. And I always think that's so funny when I think about slow medicine, you know. Oh, she took some time to look at my tongue because that's demonstrative of what's going on in the rest of my body. And so, you know, talk about some of the practices that you have that is part of slow medicine.
So in terms of what you just said, it's very interesting. So first of all, I should say that one of the reasons I wrote this second book, I didn't really think I needed to write another book until with God's Hotel, you know, I've been traveling around the country and parts of the world for the last 5 years. People really want to hear this. And one of the statements in every single talk, I think somebody stands up and says, my doctor doesn't look at me anymore. And that just strikes me because So you mentioned your naturopathic physician. You mentioned your naturopathic physician as doing exactly what I'm talking about, probably. I think that's what you were, right? She didn't just look at you. She attends. And I think one of the reasons alternative medicine has taken off so much is because the doctors who practice it, the acupuncturists, the naturopathic physicians, the homeopathists, is they still do this. They still pay attention. So for a modern medicine doc, for somebody like me who was educated, you know, did my, you know, internship in medical school and residency and all that, and I'm an internist, our practices actually grew out of the same practices of naturopathy and homeopathy in pre-modern medicine. And then as modern medicine took hold, they actually got even better in terms of examining the patient's body. But about 20, maybe 30 years ago, things really began to change as we began getting these remarkable technologies that saw inside the body, CT scans and MRIs and scopes and all this kind of stuff. And as they've taken hold, doctors have begun to neglect the actual physical examination of the body. So what I do is what I was taught, and it's examining the body. It's a modern medical exam, you could say, but it actually comes out of the very same tradition that you're talking about, of the naturopathic, that has sort of been left on the side. These days, most modern medical docs not only have less time, less actual minutes, but all of those minutes in the last 10 years have begun to be spent staring at the computer screen.
Well, right, and that brings my question into focus. For the last five or more years when I've gone for my annual physical, first the nurse or the medical assistant comes and interviews me in front of a computer with drop-down menus, and then the doctor comes and looks at the results. Now, I've fortunately had good doctors who do look me in the eye and do a really good physical. But you do have to let me ask you this. How do you bring in slow medicine practices to the world of electronic medical records and the modern insurance industry?
You got it. That is the question of the hour. That's something I'm actually quite interested in because that is where all our time is going. I mean, you can't have slow if you are required to spend all of your time on the computer. And in fact, this is not hyperbole. There's two studies. One study about 5 years ago showed that doctors were spending 70% of their time staring at the screen. And a recent study shows that doctors are spending 110% of their time staring at the screen. Wow. Not just all of their time, but they have to go home and spend another 2 hours staring at the screen. Mm, yeah. So the electronic health records you talk about, so I talk about slow medicine being the efficiency of inefficiency, because it seems inefficient for the doctor to actually look at the patient and talk to the patient, but it turns out to be the cheaper than this other kind of medicine we're talking about, healthcare, providing healthcare. But the computer screen and electronic health records, which were supposed to be efficient, take all our time, are completely inefficient. And part of that is just the nature of how they've been constructed. And I believe that we can have something akin to our old-fashioned paper charts, but have them be electronic. And that by doing that, by letting docs, I see no reason why we can't have an electronic health record where we could just write on our pads, write on paper. We should be able to just do what we need to do to understand the story of the patient.
Well, in terms of customers, rather patients, working with their insurance companies to get paid for services that slow medicine practitioners practice, does that create challenges for the insurance industry and for the copay business and all that? How does that actually work?
Well, first of all, I should say, Dave, that this is all just kind of gelling now.
Yes.
Really?
I understand.
But because there are studies that show that, let's call it slow medicine, that doctors having enough time to get the right diagnosis and the right treatment is actually cheaper, insurance companies should be very interested in this model.
Yeah.
Especially for the more complex patients, because you save money. They can save money because you get less. You have, if I can figure out pretty much what you have by talking to you and examining you and doing a few simple tests, a few simple blood tests, let's say, or an x-ray, but nothing complicated. I don't send you to consultants. I don't order huge panels of labs. And most of the time I can do that, then the insurance companies save money. So I expect it's just starting to get a few places that this as an option is starting to be something people look at. It's not being called slow medicine. The model that actually allows this out here in California is sometimes called concierge medicine and
yes.
sometimes called direct patient
right.
care. And that's what the insurance companies, I think, are going to be very interested in. It's the same model. It's a model where the doc has a lot more time with patients because he or she has fewer patients.
That just intuitively sounds more expensive. If you have fewer patients, do you have to charge each one of them more?
Well, that's very interesting. In terms of charging, it's I don't know how much you want to get into this. I mean, it's a great question. So let me see if I can explain how it works. And a primary care doctor, so your family practitioner doctor, has a panel of 2,500 patients.
Yeah.
Whoa. Okay?
What?
That's impossible panel. It's impossible to do that. It's literally impossible.
Right.
So consequently, when you go to your doc, if they have that kind of practice, which is what people have, they have like literally 2.5 minutes to see you.
Mm-hmm.
So you come in. There's nothing the doctor can do except re-prescribe your medications, send you for labs, send you for x-rays, send you to specialists. There's no time to do that. And it's the labs, it's the technology, and the consultants that are expensive. Mm-hmm. And let me give you it's really shifting what we pay for from labs, consultants, and x-rays to primary care doctors so that they can have more time, so that they will order fewer of these expensive tests, have the capacity to get you off the expensive medication you probably don't need, but nobody has the time to go like, well, does he really need 3 blood pressure medicines? Does he really have diabetes? Those kind of questions.
Good summary.
So although it sounds more expensive, the part of it is that we only spend out of our healthcare budget, just to give you some sense of what I'm talking about, really, out of a dollar we spend on healthcare, 5 cents of it, 5 cents, goes to primary care doctors.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if we doubled the time, doubled it, so right, completely doubled it, it's only 10 cents
yeah.
of our dollar. And it will. We know that from studies of direct patient care and concierge medicine that doctors who have the right number of patients for them to do a good job, those patients have 40% fewer emergency room visits and 15% fewer hospitalizations.
Wow, it just makes such logical sense, but a lot of times we don't operate in many industries under common sense and logic. If you're just joining us, our guest is Dr. Victoria Sweet. She's the author of God's Hotel. She's now back with a new book called Slow Medicine, The Way to Healing. And I just want to point out, maybe ask you to tell a story that's in your book, because you're a great writer and you relate a lot of stories, a lot of anecdotes about your time and how you arrived at wanting to practice slow medicine and what you learned about fast medicine and healthcare. And I'm thinking specifically when you were at Kaiser Hospital in San Francisco, and a woman with lymphocytic leukemia, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, Mrs. C, you call her. Tell us story and what you learned from that.
Oh, my gosh, that was really traumatic for me, I have to say. I was an intern, and being an intern means you don't have any power, really, at all at that point. You don't have your license yet, and so you really have to... You're kind of the person who does all the back work and examines the patient and writes the orders. But if you really aren't comfortable with some of what you're asked to do or told to do, you don't have much of a choice. And for me, in some ways, Mrs. Carmona demonstrates what was that there was about 3 layers to the story. So she was a lovely 70-year-old woman who'd had CLL for about 11 years. And she just came into the hospital. I was her intern, and she was sick with something. And basically, we never really understood what it was. She was in the hospital for 2 months. And we did every single test on her to try and figure out what it was. And she was gradually dying of whatever it was, probably cancer. But her oncologist, who was quite proud of his oncology, couldn't find any cancer. And because he couldn't find any cancer, he decided she couldn't possibly be dying of cancer, and he couldn't find anything else. And so she ended up being in the ICU for about 60 days. And I watched her die while we continued to do every single thing we could think of. And as a side issue, or well, not a side issue, really, she had a very loving family who couldn't understand what was going on and couldn't accept either that she was dying. And we really couldn't figure out why, but it was clear she was dying. And it was only when one of the ICU nurses took me into the little call room and sat me down and looked me in the eye, and Mrs. C had been in their ICU for about 58 days at that time, and it was awful. Her hair, she was like 80 pounds. It was just horrible. And looked me in the eye and said, "What are you doing? Mrs. C is dying." And it was only at that point I kind of went back in the room and looked at her and went, "What are we doing?" And because I was an intern, I couldn't get the oncologist to see this person and admit the fact that she was, in fact, past the point of no return, that there was a past the point of no return that we don't recognize in modern medicine.
Right.
So he continued to require me to do all these tests, and she dwindled until the day that she died, which was 2 hours after I went off service and handed her over to a different intern, who was able to sort of step back and do what I wasn't able to do, just intellectually and morally, which was just not pay attention.
Yeah. This story and others were what moved you, or what helped move you, over into Slow Medicine, which is the name of your new book. It's The Way to Healing, and our guest is Dr. Victoria Sweet. Thank you so much for joining us today on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
And we want to thank Dr. Victoria Sweet and our other guests today, Doug Abrams with the Book of Joy and the Book of Joy Journal, as well as Albert DeSilva with the Writing is a Path to Awakening, a Year to Becoming an Excellent Writer and Living an Awakened Life. And let's thank our underwriters, Dave.
You bet. Thank you, underwriters, for helping us with our book day.
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
SFO Design.
As in San Francisco Design. Phil Davidson Orthopedics.
Park City Mountain.
Utah Olympic Legacy Foundation.
Fairway Independent Mortgage.
And Valley Behavioral Health.
Spend the day outdoors at Utah Olympic Park. Save when you buy a gold pass. Valid for unlimited day use of the zip lines, adventure courses, and much more. Activities are open Saturday and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. until October 22nd. Details at UtahOlympicLegacy.org.
Utah Olympic Park is a nonprofit organization dedicated to providing winter sport and recreation opportunities, and a KPCW supporter.
Hi, I'm Whitney Wall from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain hosts winter events throughout the season, including Snowfest, the annual Torchlight Parade, New Year's Eve celebration, Spring Groove, and more. More information about all the events happening at Park City Mountain this winter can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com. Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com. Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
It's KPCW Park.